question. Is it acceptable to pursue your own selfish satisfaction when it causes risk to someone else? Question. Is it okay to risk another's life or happiness simply because you really want something?
My father thought I was playing games with people's lives, Frankie said. He said what I was doing was immoral.
Jason reacted with impatience. What did Marvin understand about morality? He was the least emotional person I ever knew. Forget about all of his academic posturing.
I would, but now I wonder if he was right. Maybe Bryn and Monica are dead because of me. Maybe I'm playing with fire.
Her voice turned smoky.
Remember Darren Newman?
He didn't like hearing that name, and she couldn't blame him. You didn't make Darren Newman the man he is.
Tell that to the girl who was killed, Frankie said.
Newman manipulated you, and a lot of other people, too.
Frankie didn't say anything more.
Jason was right. Darren Newman had come to her as part of a deal to stay out of prison, and she wasn't responsible for the consequences.
Except they both knew that wasn't the whole truth.
She turned and faced her husband. Between the wine and the darkness of the solarium, she felt herself getting aroused. That was a rare experience this year. Her mind and her body had been strangers to each other, but right now, she wanted an escape from everything else. From memories, from loss, from her past. Her inhibitions fell away. Her fingers played with the down on the back of his neck. She kissed his lower lip, and then teased him with her tongue. And she felt him respond. Her hands undid a button on his shirt, then another, and one of her fingernails explored his chest. She didn't care if the world was watching them through the windows. It had been way too long, and she needed him urgently. He sensed it. His hand tugged at the zipper of her dress pants, and when it was down, his fingers fished inside, rubbing her through the lace of her panties. Her breath caught in her chest. Her legs slipped apart. She braced herself against him. Then, out of the corner of her eye, she saw movement in the living room, and she froze in embarrassment. Pam. She'd come out of her downstairs bedroom. She wore her shorty nightgown with a mug of tea cradled in her hands. Her blonde hair was mussed. She stood there watching them, a smirk on her lips. Frankie stepped away. Trying to be discreet, she zipped up and smoothed her hair and blouse. Jason's face screwed up in annoyance until he glanced over his shoulder. Pam wiggled her fingers in a sarcastic greeting, and then she returned to her bedroom and closed the door loudly. They were alone again, but the moment was broken. When Frankie kissed him again, she didn't get the same erotic response.
"Sorry," she murmured.
He shrugged. "Bad timing."
"We could go upstairs," she suggested.
"Actually, I need to finish a project. I'll work in my office for a while.
Should I wait up?"
"No, you're tired. Go to bed."
His voice had a cold, dismissive quality.
Once he'd shut the door, it didn't open again. His rejection left her humiliated but still aroused. She kicked off her heels and picked them up in one hand. She climbed the spiral staircase in her stocking feet to the loft, where they kept their master bedroom suite, and she slipped inside and closed the door behind her. It was dark. More windows faced the bay. She took off all her clothes inside the walk-in closet without looking in the full-length mirror. If she stared at her naked body, she would find fault with herself. Too skinny, with her ribs and hip bones showing, breasts too small. Right now, she wanted to think of herself as perfect. She padded nude across the lush carpet and slipped between the satin sheets of the king bed without putting on a nightgown. The coolness caressed her bare skin. Her body wanted sex, but drunkenness made the bedroom spin. She squirmed with frustrated excitement, but every time she blinked, her eyes stayed closed a little longer. She slept. Not for long. It felt like only a minute or two. She could have slept all night, but something disturbed her. She awoke with a start, feeling anxious. Her heart raced. She'd been dreaming about something bad, but the dream vanished in an instant, and she had no memory of it. When she checked the clock, she saw that an hour had passed. She was still alone. Jason was one of those people who needed little sleep himself, and he was always working. What awakened her?
Frankie looked around the bedroom, and nothing felt amiss. The curtains were open, letting in the San Francisco glow. Sometimes hawks or gulls struck their high windows so loudly she was sure the glass would shatter, but she didn't think it was one of their collisions that had jarred her awake. She looked at her nightstand, and she knew. Her phone. Frankie unlocked the screen. A new email waited for her. The date stamp was only seconds earlier. She saw the address of the sender, and it was the same person who had stalked her at Zingari. TheNightbird@gmx.com. Her skin rippled, as if someone had stroked it with a fingertip. She shivered at the chill. Normally, hate mail didn't bother her, but this was different. These messages had a quiet menace. Just like his name suggested, he felt like a bird of prey, hiding in the darkness. Instinctively, she tugged the sheet over her bare chest, as if he were somewhere among the city lights, behind the long eye of a telescope, watching her. "I see you." She almost deleted the message without reading it, but she had to know. She tapped on the email with her fingertip. The message, like the others, was a single line. "I'm going to watch you die." 11. The room was white, shimmering white, fluorescent white, blinding white. As her eyes blinked open, the woman named Christy felt lost in the whiteness. She was at peace, drifting nowhere and everywhere. The atmosphere was warm and perfectly silent. She lay on her back on a chaise, so soft and comfortable, it practically enveloped her. Wherever she was, time had no meaning here. A minute could be an hour could be a minute. She had no sense of anything but bliss. Her body felt oddly heavy. When she went to lift her arm, it wouldn't move. The same was true of her legs. Soft bonds held her firmly in place. She couldn't turn her head from side to side or lift her torso off the cushions, and yet it didn't matter. Her mind wandered freely, untethered from her frozen body, floating with a faint breath of air. Her mind was a bubble, lazily exploring the white, windowless world. Nothing could ever be wrong in that world. Nothing at all. She could stay there forever. Only one strange smudge of darkness disturbed Christie's peaceful visions. Far away, farther than her mind could see, something was missing. There was a memory she could no longer grasp, a blank space as white as the walls. When she reached for it, it darted away. The memory teased her with its emptiness. It was like a sailboat hovering on the far edge of an ocean horizon, dotting up and then disappearing. She could hardly be sure it had ever been there at all. But she knew it had. She had a sixth sense that whatever was behind that blank space was worse than anything she'd known in her life. Behind that blank space was terror. Behind it was madness. She knew, that if she had to stare at it again, her mind would shatter like glass. She could feel herself sprinting to get away from it, running without looking back at whatever terrible thing was behind her, pleading, praying, screaming, "No!" Right now that seemed impossible. Nothing so empty, so far away, could frighten her. She was as warm as sunshine. The room was as white as the sand on an endless beach. She never wanted to leave. Christie's lips folded into a smile. Her eyes sank shut again, and she slept. Beautiful dreams filled her mind, as if a voice outside her brain could tell her what to see. Meadows in bloom, with a gentle wind that she could feel on her face. A mountain lake, waveless and deep blue, scented by pine. A porch swing, empty, creaking, with a rumble of thunder in the distance. Whatever the voice told her to see, she saw. The voice. It controlled her. Suddenly it told her to awaken. It said her name in a high-pitched, sing-song way, like a child playing a game. "Christy, Christy.
She didn't want to wake up. Her dreams were too perfect. She knew she would awaken in the white room. It had all happened before. She didn't know how many times it had happened, but this wasn't the first time.
Christy. Christy.
The voice sang in her head like a nightingale. But there was nothing happy about the song. She had a memory of asking,
"Who are you?"
And she had a memory of his sing-song reply,
"The night bird, that's what you heard."
She was awake now, and she could feel him close to her. His breath was loud and scented with something sweet. She kept her eyes closed because she didn't want to see him, but he plucked one eyelid between his fingers and lifted it open like he was peering under a window shade.
"Peek-a-boo, I see you."
His face was nothing but a mask, leaning over her, inches away. The mask had a grotesque plastic smile, with blood-red lips stretching to his ears, ghost-white skin, huge eyes, the eyes of a bug, not eyes at all. The mask grinned at her, and behind it the voice sang.
"It won't be long," he warbled. "Time for the song."
Christy wanted to shut her eyes, but he used gray sticky tape to seal her eyelid to her lash, first one then the other. The moisture in her eyes dried immediately, and her eyeballs felt as if they would come loose and roll away. Pain grew in a circle in her sockets. She needed to blink. All she could think about was how much she needed to blink, but she couldn't. She could only stare at the bug eyes and hideous grin of the mask. "Not the song," she wanted to say. "Please, not the song." She remembered now. The song opened the door. The song sent her to the devil and the darkness. She wanted to scream at him and plead with him, but something was in her mouth. Cloth, filling every space, shutting out air and sound. All she could do was squeal in protest through her nose, making a whimpering noise. The mask giggled at her, like a child playing with an ant.
"The song is here," he sang. "See what you fear."
Christy screamed, not out loud, but from inside her brain. It did nothing to stop what was happening to her. The song began. The music was smooth, gentle, not scary at all. But as the lyrics played, the empty whiteness changed. Things appeared on the walls and ceiling and floor, and at first she couldn't see what they were. But then the room seemed to shrink, inch by inch, and she realized the room was lined with needles. Thousands and thousands of needles, glinting, sharp and silver, jutting out, three-dimensional, sleek and long. Oh, no, no, oh, no, 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 anything but needles. The walls moved, the ceiling moved, or that was how it felt to her. The needles grew in her vision. Christy saw other things now. Eyeballs appeared and floated in the air. Dozens of individual blue eyes with long lashes, just like hers. And as the walls ground closer, the needles punctured each eyeball, oozing blood and vitreous gel, gathering them up like meat on a skewer. She screamed and screamed and screamed and didn't make a sound. A face took shape among the needles. Not a face. The mask. Its grinning mouth opened and sang the song. The music became the soundtrack to a horror film, as the bloody needles zeroed in on her body, her skin, her face. They grew larger and larger as they came closer. The voice sang in her ear, "Christy! Christy!" And then a command, "Run!" Over and over, "Run, run, run! Run, 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 run!" She tried. She could feel her arms pumping, her legs racing, her heart hammering in her chest as she went faster and faster, but she couldn't outrun the needles. Patiently, inexorably, they came for her, to stab her, to puncture her, to slit her through and through with a thousand wounds. "Run, run, 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 run!" Christy's open eyes saw the needles. Her soundless screams became an unending wail for help. But there was no help. The glistening points of the needles filled her sight, so close she could feel the metal points pushing on the damp surface of her cornea, pricking their way inside. Her entire world became nothing but needles. There was a needle for every pore on her skin. Her mind broke. Her mind fell through a window and shattered into pieces. She wasn't even aware of the real, tiny stab of a needle in her arm, or of the terror receding as her consciousness slipped away into blackness again. 12. Frost stared at the three wooden planks fixed to the side of a sheer cliff face, making a walkway barely 18 inches wide. There was no railing, just swags of chain nailed to the rock like Christmas tinsel. On the open side of the planks, the cliff descended straight down into 1,000 feet of air. Gnarled, windswept trees sprouted from its rocky crevices. Misty mountains filled the distance. As he examined the weathered beams mounted on the rock, a 5-year-old with a vanilla ice cream cone ran through the open canyon to her mother. The tourists crowded around the painting in Ghirardelli Square laughed nervously. It was just a 3-dimensional sidewalk illusion, but it was so real that Lucy, with her vertigo, would have fainted. Frost sat down next to the artist, on the stone steps of the plaza's mermaid fountain. Water gurgled and splashed over brass turtles and bare breasts. The morning sun cast shadows across their faces. The iconic chocolate factory sign loomed above them, and he could smell sweetness in the air. "Impressive, Herb," Frost said. "Please tell me that's not a real place."
"It is, actually. That's the famous plank walk on Huatshan Mountain in China."
"Have you done it?"
"I have."
Frost wasn't surprised. Herb was the kind of man who'd lived 10 lifetimes in almost 70 years. "And why would anyone do something like that?" he asked.
"A Buddhist would probably say to gain enlightenment," Herb replied. "But honestly, I was stoned out of my mind."
Frost laughed. The omnipresent aroma of pot from Herb's paint-stained flannel shirt was enough to intoxicate anyone who spent too much time with him. He had leathery white skin, dark eyes, and black glasses with tiny magnifiers for close-up work. He was skinny and tall, and he limped because of the time he spent painting on his knees. Shaq sat in the artist's lap, and the black-and-white cat batted at the multicolored beads strung into Herb's long gray hair. They'd been friends for 15 years. Even in a melting-pot city like San Francisco, Herb was one of a kind. He knew everybody. Hippies, fishermen, gays, radicals, yuppies, techies. He'd spent 4 terms on the city council in the 80s, but for as long as Frost could remember, he'd simply painted elaborate sidewalk illusions around the city. He'd been featured on The Tonight Show and Good Morning America, and had appeared in 12 San Francisco-based movies.
"I was at your brother's food truck a couple days ago," Herb said, tickling Shaq's chin. "Looks like he's doing well."
"He is. Duane loves it. It's a big change from the brick-and-mortar kitchens."
"And your parents? How are they?"
"Enjoying Arizona. They bought a golf cart, which I find truly horrifying."
"Well, I have a pretty high threshold for horrifying," Herb chuckled. "You're talking to someone who once got a ticket for riding a Segway on 101. Anyway, it must be lonely not having them around."
"I get why they moved," Frost said. "Too many memories." Frost thought about Francesca Stein, and realized that everything in life came down to memories. The good, the bad, the real, the imagined. Put them all together, and that was the person you were. Would you ever want to change that? He wondered if his parents would choose to erase that night 6 years ago if they could. The night he had to tell them about Katie.
"So what's up, Frost?" Herb asked. "You don't usually brave the tourist crowds on Saturday morning. I assume that means you need my help."
"I do," Frost said. He often consulted with Herb, because his friend had a pipeline into prominent people around the city, and knew most of the street dwellers, too. Herb heard rumors, and sucked up secrets like a private detective. He wrote a daily blog about San Francisco life that was required reading for journalists and politicians. "Dr. Francesca Stein," Frost went on. "Do you know her?"
"Oh, yes. The master of memory."
"That's her."
"What do you want to know?" Herb asked. "She's lovely, but there's steel behind those eyes."
"Is she legit? The whole memory game sounds like a con to me. Can you really erase a memory from someone's head? Or create a memory of something that never happened?
You think it's something out of a Michael Crichton novel?"
"Honestly, yeah."
"I don't think so, Frost. The older I get, the more I realize that memory is like one of my sidewalk illusions. It can look very real, and be nothing but a fantasy. I remember things that I know are false, and I forget things that I know really happened. I talked to someone who went to Dr. Stein for her memory treatment. One of our esteemed city politicians, actually. He killed a pedestrian as a teenage driver, and it began giving him nightmares years after it happened. Dr. Stein worked with him. He still remembers that the accident happened, but he doesn't remember it happening. Is that a good thing? I don't know, but it's real, and his nightmares are gone.
Nobody could make me forget finding Katie's body.
You would think that's true, Herb said. But don't be so sure. The fact that it's possible to alter memories is why so many scientists are adamant about our not doing it. They accuse Dr. Stein of opening Pandora's box. I tend to agree with them, even if I had a fairly fluid sense of reality back in the 1960s.
Herb turned his attention to a child standing in front of them on the bottom step of the fountain. The boy was about 6 years old, with messy blonde hair.
"How may I help you, young man?"
Herb asked in a booming voice. He was good with kids.
"Is that real?"
the boy asked, gesturing at the three-dimensional painting of Hwasun Mountain in the plaza.
"Does it look real?" Herb asked him.
"Yeah."
"Then I guess it is."
The boy thought about this. He looked over his shoulder at the painting.
"I don't think it's real. I think it's fake."
"There's only one way to find out," Herb said. "You have to walk the plank, young man."
The boy folded his arms and marched back to the edge of the painting using big steps, but he kept eyeing Herb behind him, as if to figure out whether he was kidding. He put a foot out and drew it back, and then, with a last glance at Herb, he jumped into the center of the painting. When his feet landed on cement, he looked back with a huge grin. Herb winked at him.
"So why are you asking about this, Frost?" Herb went on. "You're not thinking of going to Dr. Stein, are you? Because of Katie?"
"No."
"Then why? Did something happen?"
"Two of Dr. Stein's patients killed themselves in odd circumstances." Herb's face darkened.
"The girl on the bridge?"
Frost nodded. He found himself whistling a song under his breath.
"She was one." "Are you trying to hold Dr. Stein criminally responsible?" Herb asked. "I wish you luck, but that's a stretch. I can't see the DA taking that case."
"I just want to find out what really happened."
"Well, I have to confess I'm biased about Dr. Stein, and not in a good way."
"Oh? And why is that?"
"Do you remember last summer, the SF State student who was murdered in her apartment near Balboa Park? Her name was Marilyn Summers. She was stabbed 7 times.
Frost's brow wrinkled. "I remember, but Jess Salceda led that case, not me."
"How about the name Darren Newman?" Herb asked.
"Newman was a suspect in the murder, but he was never charged. Jess got a DNA match on someone else in the building, and the guy pled out. He claimed to have been so drunk, he didn't remember anything that happened that night." Herb nodded. Shaq nudged the old man's hand impatiently, and when Herb didn't respond by petting him, the cat got up and relocated to Frost's shoulder. He lifted his face to smell a waft of sea air.
"You know, I'm on the board for a women's anti-violence coalition, right?"
Herb asked.
"Sure." "Darren Newman has been on our radar for several years," Herb said. "Women started complaining about him shortly after he and his parents moved to the Bay Area from Colorado. Bullying, abuse, assault. I met him once, just to see who this man was. He's a sociopath. Slick, charming, and absolutely amoral."
"I recall Newman having some kind of criminal record, but he'd never done time," Frost said.
"Yes. His parents are venture capital billionaires. They paid off victims. Nobody filed charges. Then about 18 months ago, Newman dated the niece of one of our board members, and he raped her. The parents tried to buy her off, but she didn't want money. She wanted him in jail. She was willing to go to trial and take her chances persuading a jury, but the parents pulled a new maneuver. They paid a psychiatrist to offer evidence to the judge."
Foss could see where this was going.
"Dr. Stein," he said. "That's right. Stein talked about traumatic incidents in Newman's childhood and suggested treatment rather than incarceration. Newman copped to a misdemeanor, no jail time. Court-ordered therapy with Stein. Nobody was happy."
"And Marilyn Summers?"
"She got stabbed 3 months later. She lived 2 doors down from Darren Newman. Look, Frost, I know what the DNA test showed, and I know Jess Salceda did a thorough investigation before going after that other man in the building. But I have to tell you,
Everyone in our coalition believed that Darren Newman was guilty. He raped and killed that girl, and he managed to pin it on someone else. What's even worse is that he never would have been on the street at all if it weren't for Dr. Francesca Stein.
13. Frankie parked by the promenade trail on the bay. The Golden Gate Bridge loomed immediately to the west, but the bridge was enveloped in a ridge of fog and almost invisible. San Francisco near the Presidio was often like a different city. Even when it was sunny and warm downtown, the temperature could be 20 degrees colder close to the ocean, where a damp cloud laid its chilly fingers across the coast. She stretched in the parking lot, finished the morning coffee she'd brought with her, and took off running toward Crissy Field and the bridge. She liked to push herself hard on her Saturday morning workouts. Jason ran more often than she did, but when she ran fast and easily outpaced him. It annoyed him, and as a result, they no longer ran together. She felt good running again, because she'd missed the last 2 weekends. She let her long legs stretch out on the dirt path, passing most of the other runners, ignoring the cold bay wind that whistled into her face. Her arms pumped, her cheeks pinked up, and sweat gathered under her headband. Normally she cleared her head when she ran, but the overnight threat lingered in her brain. "I'm going to watch you die." She'd hardly slept. She kept telling herself that the email was no more than a variation of the same kind of hate mail she received every day. Sometimes the work she did made her enemies. She'd forwarded the email to a private security firm she'd used in the past and asked them to look into it. End of story. Even so, thinking about it made her shiver. Frankie ran full speed with the beach beside her. Whitecaps broke on the surface of the bay. She tasted salt on her tongue. At Torpedo Wharf, she continued around the bluff, following the paved road all the way to Fort Point below the bridge. She could see the webbed red metal of the Golden Gate here, behind the ghosts of fog. At the fort, she stopped long enough to catch her breath. She bent over, with her hands on her knees. She always thought of Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo, in this spot, rescuing Kim Novak from a fake suicide attempt in the frigid bay waters. She'd watched the movie over and over as a teenager, trying to understand Stewart's dangerous obsession. That was when she'd begun to think of mental health as a career. She remembered telling her father about her plans to be a psychiatrist. He was appalled. To him, psychiatry wasn't science. It was nothing more than astrology with a prescription pad. For years, she'd endured his nasty jokes. "What's the difference between physics and psychiatry? One's full of quarks and the other's full of quacks." And then he'd laughed. He had the meanest laugh of anyone she'd ever met. If he were still alive, he'd be laughing at her now, blaming her for what happened to Bryn and Monica. "Psychiatrists are like children pushing buttons on a machine they don't understand," he would say. "And now look what you've done. These women trusted you, and you killed them." Except it wasn't Marvin's voice in her head, blaming her for what happened. It was her own. Frankie started running back toward the city skyline. She ran even faster, so that the noise of her breathing blocked out other sounds. If she couldn't hear, she couldn't think, and she didn't want to think right now. She focused on the domed roof of the Palace of Fine Arts, and beyond it, the hilltop skyscrapers, including the pyramid of the Transamerica building. Beside her, the beach sand was wet and brown, and the morning was gray. She wove through the Saturday crowd, trying not to slow down. She ran so fast that she sprinted right by the man on the bench. Among the blur of faces, someone was watching her. By the time she passed him, she realized that his face was familiar. It took her brain a moment to catch up, and then she knew who it was. She stopped and reversed her tracks, walking back toward the bench, breathing hard. He waited for her. Frankie put on a neutral smile. "Todd." "Hello, Dr. Stein." She was going to comment on what a surprise this was, but she didn't think it was a surprise. You could always run into someone you knew in San Francisco, but she saw in his face that he'd been expecting her. She felt paranoid, but it was only because of the strange email she'd received. Looking at Todd, she couldn't remember now whether he was one of the patients with whom she'd shared her personal email address. Frankie sat down next to him. "It's been a while." "5 months." "And how are you?" she asked. "Honestly, not so good." Frankie didn't say anything immediately. She let her breathing return to normal. The pedestrians came and went on the trail, ignoring them, but she spoke softly. "I'm sorry to hear that. Why don't you call and make an appointment next week, and we'll talk?" "No, I can't do that," Todd said. "I can't go to your office." "Why not?" "Because you take notes. You have to do that legally, right? But I don't want anything written down." Frankie leaned forward with her hands on her knees. She stared at her sneakers. "So this isn't an accident. Did you follow me?" "No, because I have to be honest with you, Todd. I don't like being stalked, and that's what this feels like." He shook his head. "I'm sorry, Dr. Stein, I didn't follow you. I just remembered that you told me how much you liked running this trail on the weekends, and I thought I would take my chances." Her instinct was to get up and walk away. Todd wasn't the first patient to cross the line between personal and professional. She'd had patients show up at her home and invite her to Thanksgiving and make clumsy passes at her. The thing to do was to shut them down calmly and politely. Even so, she didn't. There was something in Todd's voice that made her stay. His full name was Todd Ferris. He was in his late 20s, tall and bony. He had a wistful face with faraway eyes, a feminine mouth, and a soft-spoken way of talking that made her lean in to hear him better. A gathering of longer hairs along his chin line pretended to be a beard. He wore a navy wool cap, a gray Boomtown Casino sweatshirt, and jeans. A small loop earring hugged one ear, and a silver cross dangled on a chain around his neck. He wasn't one of her success stories. He'd come to her months earlier, troubled by memories of bullying he'd suffered as a child. The emotional trauma had worsened since he'd taken a new job at one of the large gaming companies, with a demanding and intimidating boss. He'd been unable to sleep or work. He'd started drinking heavily. As a patient, Todd was hard to draw out. He was vague about whether the past abuse was sexual, which made her suspect that it was. He was reluctant to share details about his family and whether anyone else knew what his cousin had done to him. He'd grown up in a Nevada small town, and it was obvious that he still carried a stigma about therapy. Many people were like that. If you went to a psychiatrist, you were crazy or weak. She'd tried several approaches with Todd, but he was resistant to hypnosis, and he'd declined drugs to improve his suggestibility. In the end, he'd thanked her and walked away. She didn't think she'd helped him at all. "So what's going on, Todd?" He stared off at the dark waters of the bay. His face twitched, as if his brain and mouth were struggling with what to say. "Something really weird is happening to me."
"What is it?"
"I'm having strange memories," he told her.
"Of your cousin?" she asked. "Of what he did to you?"
"No. This is completely different. I'm remembering things that never happened. And yet it's like they did."
"I don't understand."
"Yeah, me neither. I mean, it's like waking up from a dream where you have flashbacks of what was in your head, but you can't really put them together. I see things, I remember things, but only fragments. They're disconnected, like somebody snipped pieces out of a video. I'd swear they were dreams, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like I'm remembering something that really happened. I can't explain it."
Frankie was silent as she processed what Todd was saying. He went on in a voice that was so soft she struggled to hear him.
"I was just wondering if this could be a side effect of what we did."
"You mean the therapy?"
"Uh-huh." "No, I'm sure this is something else, Todd." "You mean I can't remember false things? Because online they talk about recovered memories that aren't true. People will remember things that never actually happened to them."
"I really don't think that's what this is."
He nodded, but he looked doubtful. "Okay, whatever you say, but I'm scared. I don't like what's going on in my head."
"How long have you felt this way?"
Todd rubbed a hand across his face. He blinked and looked lost. "The first time was 2 months ago, and then it stopped, so I figured it was some weird one-time thing. But this week it happened again." "What exactly do you remember?" Frankie asked him.
"Torture."
Frankie recoiled.
"What?"
"That's what I remember, Dr. Stein. Horrible shit. The pictures in my head, they're graphic and violent." Her mind was in a whirl. "Did this happen to you? Were you suffering some kind of physical or mental abuse?"
"No, I saw it. I was watching it. It's like I was a witness, you know?"
"Who was being tortured?" Frankie asked.
"A woman? Women, actually. It's happened more than once."
"What happened to them? Who was doing this?"
"I'm not sure I can describe it. It's all bits and pieces. There's this white room, and the woman is on a bed or chaise or something. She's like, I don't know, she looks drugged. Tied up, too, so she can't move. And I remember some guy in a creepy-ass mask. He's the one torturing her."
"A mask?"
"Yeah. Some weird grinning mask with bug eyes. Scary as shit. I mean, it's so bizarre, it can't be real, right? But I feel like it happened."
"Have you told anyone else about this?" Frankie asked.
"Are you kidding? No way. Like I said, no notes, right? I don't want anybody thinking I'm nuts. You can't tell anyone about this, can you? Doctor-patient privilege or whatever."
"That's right," she said.
Todd exhaled in relief.
"Good."
Frankie hesitated. This wasn't the kind of question she usually asked a patient. You didn't challenge their hallucinations.
"Listen, Todd, can you tell me one other thing? You said this felt like a dream, and yet you seemed convinced that it really happened. Why?"
He slid closer to her on the bench. She was uncomfortable with the lack of personal space between them. He eyed the bay trail to make sure that no one else was within earshot. He looked frightened now.
"When this happened 2 months ago, I thought it was a dream, too," he said. "But then I realized it couldn't be."
"Why not?"
"Because the women I saw are real. I saw them on TV. That chick who threw herself off the bridge this week, she was one of the women in the white room. I mean, I don't know her. I've never met her. I don't know who she is. But I remember her."
14. Frost waited for the cable car to pass, and then he crossed into Union Square. He finished a foot-long hot dog as he walked. Ketchup, pickle relish, no onions. It drove his brother crazy that Frost ate so many hot dogs. Duane was a chef, and he didn't appreciate Frost's argument that street vendor hot dogs were better than just about any other food in the world. The sun beat down on his neck. Entering the plaza, he passed under the palm trees. The Macy's building was across the square on his right. People swarmed the park, clustering around musicians, mimes, jugglers, and acrobats. Above the street music, he heard the chants and drums of protesters, and he could see hand-painted signs waving in the air. It was San Francisco. Someone was always protesting something. He found the terrace steps leading down to Geary Street, and it took him a minute to spot Lucy Hagen among the 100 or so people eating lunch on the steps on the warm afternoon. She was small and alone, watching the world go by with a dreamy expression on her face. She wore a belted red dress with black stripes at the hem. Her knees were pressed together, and she wore red high heels. The dress showed off her pretty arms and legs. Her brown hair nestled on her shoulders. He squeezed his way down the steps and slid to the ground beside her. He whistled a tune that had been stuck in his head all day. "Hey, Lucy," he said.
"Oh, hey, Frost,"
she welcomed him with a smile. "Sorry to interrupt your lunch break, but I had a few more questions for you."
"That's okay. I like the company."
Her lunch consisted of a couscous salad with olives and artichoke hearts. She took dainty, uninterested bites with a plastic fork. He guessed that if he'd offered to buy her a hot dog, she would have jumped at the chance. "You look great," he said.
"Have to look good for the Macy's customers, you know."
But he could tell she was pleased with the compliment. Lucy always looked a little lost when he saw her. Some single women owned the city, and some looked overwhelmed by it. Her big, curious eyes followed the people around her. She was a watcher, not a doer. He had the feeling that she stared at other San Franciscans on the street and wondered how they could make it look so easy. The businessmen, the construction workers in bright yellow, the drag queens, even the homeless wrapped in blankets.
She noticed him studying her face, and went back to her lunch in embarrassment. Her mouth twitched into a frown. "Have they found Bryn's body yet?"
"No." Lucy shivered.
"That's awful."
"It is. I'm sorry."
"I checked with her supervisor, by the way. Bryn missed a day of work this week. She didn't show up. She didn't call."
"And you have no idea where she was?" he asked.
"No."
Frost craned his neck to study the plaza.
"Did you say Dr. Stein's office is nearby?"
Lucy pointed at a tall building on Stockton, on the east side of the square. "She works in there."
"Did Bryn say anything about seeing Dr. Stein lately? Is there a chance she could have gone to her for some kind of follow-up appointment?"
"I don't think so. She didn't mention it."
"Did she say anything at all about Dr. Stein recently?"
"On the bridge, when we were stuck up there, she suggested I talk to her. She said she was pretty good. That's it."
"Okay. Thanks."
Lucy closed the plastic lid on her salad, as if she weren't hungry anymore. She put her chin up, savoring the sun.
"I love hanging out here, don't you? Especially on the weekends. It's so crazy. All the street performers, all the wild get-ups."
"There's nothing like it in the world," Frost agreed.
She played with her hair, wrapping a curl around one of her fingers.
"So did you always know you wanted to be a detective? Were you one of those little boys who played cops and robbers all the time?"
Frost shook his head. "No. When I was a kid, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do."
"That's like me. I still don't."
"Yeah, it's different for some people. My brother Dwayne knew he was going to be a chef when he was 5 years old. He was cooking dinner for all of us by the time he was 7.
"People like that amaze me," Lucy said. "I wish I had a dream like that, but I don't."
Frost shrugged. "I think the rest of the world is more like you and me. We just kind of find our way. Things happen, and we figure it all out as we go."
"Well, I'm still trying to figure it out," Lucy replied.
"You've got time. When I was your age, I was just getting out of USF law school. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do."
"Oh, my God, you're a lawyer?" Lucy asked.
"I hope that doesn't destroy your opinion of me."
"No, it's just, why aren't you practicing law?"
"Like I said, things happen," Frost told her. "I went to SF State as an undergrad and got a dual degree in history and criminology. I was really only interested in history, but my parents said I should get some practical value out of my college education. They pushed law school on me, too. Dwayne was working 90 hours a week at minimum wage as a cook, and I think they figured one of the Easton boys should go make some money. It didn't work out that way."
"Why not?"
"Well, for one thing, there were no jobs for lawyers when I got out." "That's okay. I would have hated it."
"So you joined the police?" Lucy asked.
"Nope."
She was confused. "What did you do?"
"I drove a taxi for 2 years.
Lucy laughed. She reached out and touched his shoulder, and then quickly drew her hand back. "Wow, you really are full of surprises."
"I liked it," Frost said. "I got to know the ins and outs of the city, all the back roads and back routes. That still comes in pretty handy."
"Why'd you quit?"
"I got robbed too many times. I had too many people throw up in my cab. So I hooked up with a high school buddy down on the wharf. We ran fishing charters for a year. We slept on the boat. I liked being on the water, but I smelled like fish all the time, and girls didn't really go for that."
Frost was enjoying his trip down memory lane, but he knew how it ended. He felt a tightness in his stomach.
"Things happen, and you figure out where you're going, but it doesn't mean what happens is good."
"Then I spent 6 months working on Alcatraz as a tour guide. I loved that, being a history buff. It was my favorite job."
"But only 6 months?" Lucy asked.
"Only 6 months."
"What happened? Did you get laid off?"
Frost glanced at Lucy and then glanced away. They were the same age, Lucy and Katie, both 25.
"No. My sister was murdered," Frost told her.
Lucy's big eyes flew open even wider. He heard her inhale sharply. Without a word or thought, she wrapped her arms around him and held him tightly.
"Oh, my God, Frost. I don't know what to say."
"Thanks. There's nothing to say."
She let him go, but she held onto his hand.
"That's so terrible."
"Yeah. Katie was a sweet kid."
He was about to say she was your age, but he didn't. He was about to say, "You remind me of her," but he didn't. I found her in the back seat of her car. It was... He stopped. It was a scene only the devil would understand. There are so many ripple effects when something like that happens, he went on. My parents separated for a while, and only reconciled a couple years ago. They left the city, moved to Tucson. They couldn't handle being here anymore. Duane and I actually grew closer. We were so different, and we'd never spent much time together, but without Katie, we were all we had. And you became a cop, Lucy concluded. Yes, I became a cop. Suddenly the criminology degree, the law degree, seemed to make sense in the world. Up to that point, they didn't. But I guess there's a weird synchronicity to life. The puzzle pieces come together eventually. Lucy still clung to his hand.
Did you catch the guy?
Yes, we got him. My lieutenant was the detective on the case. Now he's gone away for good. Honestly, I don't always know how to deal with it. That guy completely changed my life. I'm sitting here right now because of a murderer. He shook his head and gave a silent, unhappy laugh. Sorry, Lucy. I don't mean to drag you down with my stories.
No, I'm glad you told me.
I don't have any stories like that. Be glad you don't.
I don't know. I want there to be something, you know? I feel like I'm not going anywhere. I think I'd rather be like you. Drive a cab or live on a fishing boat or work on Alcatraz instead of selling jewelry to rich old women.
Nothing's stopping you, Frost said.
Except myself.
Lucy checked the time on her phone.
I better go. Break's over.
Sorry, one more question.
Sure.
Did Bryn tell you anything about her treatments with Dr. Stein? I'm trying to find out more about how this memory thing really works.
No, she didn't talk about it, but she seemed fine afterward. Nothing was wrong as far as I could tell.
She didn't give you any details.
Not really. But if you want to find out more about it, I know someone who can help.
Who? Frost asked.
Me.
You? What do you mean? Lucy looked embarrassed.
I decided to talk to Dr. Stein about my Jephyrophobia. It's stupid living in the Bay Area and freaking out about bridges. I want to know if she thinks she can help me.
I'm not sure that's a good idea right now, Frost said.
Oh, I won't do any treatments yet. I probably can't even afford it. I just figured I'd do an initial consultation to find out what it's all about. That's what you want, too, isn't it?
Lucy, don't do this for me. Really.
But it might help you anyway, right?
It might, Frost admitted.
Well, there you go. Win-win for both of us. I have an appointment on Monday afternoon. We can talk afterward.
Lucy didn't give him a chance to object. She pushed herself off the step and smoothed her red dress. Frost got up, too, and their bodies accidentally bumped together in the hustle-bustle of the crowd. Lucy's mouth puckered, as if she had an impulse to kiss him. He diffused the moment by reaching out to shake her hand. She took it, and her palm had a nervous dampness.
"Bye, Frost," she said,
with a twinge of disappointment on her face. "Goodbye, Lucy." She turned and skipped down the steps, dodging between the crowds. He watched her until she disappeared through the revolving door at Macy's, and then he turned back to the park. As he climbed into the plaza, he nearly collided with a tall man who wore a white flowing robe and a bizarre mask that completely covered his face. The mask featured a red-lipped grin from ear to ear, long white fangs, and huge bug eyes. A black wig of dreadlocks hung down his head. Frost was startled, but weirdness was the coin of the realm in San Francisco. "Sorry," he said. The mask bobbed up and down, and the man replied in a sing-song falsetto.
"Sorry,"
he chanted.
"Sorry."
Frost continued past the man into the square. He was 50 yards away beneath the palm trees when he remembered what Lucy had told him about the man on the bridge. The man wearing a strange mask, 2 cars away from Bryn Lansing. Frost didn't like coincidences. He ran back to the steps of the plaza and scanned the crowd. He looked everywhere, but the man in the mask had already vanished. 15. Frankie spent the evening alone at Singari. Jason texted that he was in his laboratory, and Pam still wasn't speaking to her after their last argument.
She sat at a window table beginning at 6 o'clock, and by the time she got to her fourth glass of wine, darkness had taken over the neighborhood outside the restaurant. She had her Kindle with her. She started the night by reading The Myth of Repressed Memory by Elizabeth Loftus, but at the halfway point in the bottle of Pinot Noir, she switched to The Magus by John Foles. When she heard the ping on her phone, she knew her mysterious stalker was back. She opened the email and saw, "She needs you." He was baiting her to write back, but instead she forwarded the email to Pell Security, and then she called the CEO of the company to see if they'd had any luck tracing the overnight message to its source. She reached him, but he didn't have any good news. The GMX account had been accessed via a generic IP address on a public Wi-Fi server and couldn't be linked to an individual. He also confirmed that the center had been logged in at Zingari on Friday while she was there. The Nightbird was definitely watching her. Frankie hung up her phone and spent a long time examining every face in the restaurant. No one looked back at her. No one looked familiar. She realized that the stranger had what he wanted. He was playing with her head. "Everything okay?" Virgil asked as he refilled her glass, emptying the bottle. His lavish white forelock spilled down his forehead. He was dressed in the usual black uniform, which he wore a size too small to show off his physique. "More love letters," Frankie said. She connected a charger to her phone to juice the battery. "Well, aren't you the lucky one?" "Not so lucky. This one says he wants to watch me die." The dark brows over Virgil's hawk-like eyes arched in surprise. His smirk froze as he tried to figure out whether she was joking. "Seriously?" "Seriously. Are you going to call the cops or something?" "They won't do anything. They'll come if he shows up waving a gun, but short of that, I'm on my own," she added. "He was in here last night, Virgil." "The hell you say?" "My security company traced him to the Wi-Fi at the restaurant. Was anyone asking about me, or watching me? Just that tasty cop." "Keep an eye open, okay?" Frankie asked. "If you see somebody, let me know." "My eyes are always open," Virgil said. Frankie went back to her wine. She picked at the plate of yellowfin tuna in front of her. She gazed at Post Street to see if anyone lingered in the arched entrances of the Marriott, but no one outside the hotel paid special attention to the windows at Zingari. She wondered if she should call the CEO at Pell Security again and ask him to provide personal protection for a few days. She'd had to do that once before, when the Darren Newman case exploded. The knifing death of the young woman Marilyn Summers had put Frankie in the headlines, and she'd received anonymous threats from people who were convinced that she'd set a killer free. Legally, she was blameless, but morally, she couldn't shake her own sense of guilt. She was relieved when Newman was cleared, but her doubts about him had never gone away. Frankie felt surrounded by ghosts in the restaurant. Her father, Darren Newman, the Nightbird, and now Todd Ferris, too, the man at the Bay Trail with his memories of torture in a white room. She wasn't convinced that what Todd had experienced was real. Some people made up stories that put themselves at the center of current events. It made them feel important. His descriptions also had a hallucinatory quality, maybe from drugs, maybe from dreams. Even his recollection of Bryn Lansing, if it had happened at all, could be easily explained. Bryn worked near Frankie's building. He might well have seen her as he was going in or out of the Union Square office. She'd urged Todd to schedule an appointment, but he declined. He still didn't want anything in writing. And then he'd left. That was that. She wondered if she would hear from him again. Virgil slid into the chair opposite her. He smoothed his beautiful hair. "Want company?"
"Yes."
"Oh, good, because I wasn't going to give you a choice.
Can I ask you a question, Virgil?"
9 inches, he said.
Oh, TMI,
Frank replied, knowing she was drunk and not particularly caring.
"No, I want to know if you take drugs."
"Say it a little louder, honey," Virgil told her. Frankie realized she was almost shouting, and she was glad the noise of the restaurant drowned her out. She lowered her voice and leaned across the table and took Virgil's hands.
"Sorry. Do you?"
"Are you a cop now?"
"No."
Well then, duh. Of course I do.
Are you careful?
I'm careful about all things I allow inside my body. It pays to be cautious, no?
It does, she added. What drugs do you take?
His teeth flashed behind his plump lips. Are you in the market? Do you need me to hook you up?
No, just curious.
Well, I don't usually share that information with people I'm not sleeping with, Virgil said. But since you're a friend, let's just say I don't discriminate between legal and illegal pharmaceuticals.
Have you heard anything on the street about bad drugs? Laced heroin, PCP, bath salts? Any reports of extreme hallucinogenic reactions?
Only among your patients, Virgil replied. Her face bloomed with shock and anger, and he held up his hands in surrender.
Sorry, honey, that was nasty. Pam was in here for lunch. She told me what's going on. Didn't mean to poke the porcupine.
Frankie leaned back in her chair and shook her head.
Am I an evil person, Virgil?
What, for messing with minds? Some minds need to be messed with.
I change reality for people, Frankie said.
Because they ask you to, right?
Yes, but maybe I have no business playing God with what's real and what's not. My father accused me of being no better than a lobotomist.
What a charming man Marvin was, Virgil said.
Can I tell you a secret? I don't really miss him. I can't even say I'm sorry he's dead. I've never said that to another human being, not even Jason.
It lifted a burden for her to say the words out loud. She'd felt that way for months. Her father had been emotionally abusive to her and Pam his whole life, making them feel small, making them feel worthless. To have him gone was a relief. It was horrible, but it was the truth.
Do you feel guilty for feeling that way?
Virgil asked. In black, he looked like a priest in the confessional.
Yes.
Well, don't.
He was my father.
And that means what exactly? It's biology. He donated a sperm cell. Is that some kind of noble act? Parenthood ain't the sex, honey. It's everything that comes after.
Is your father still alive?
Frankie asked. I have no idea, but I suppose he is. I don't think God is too anxious to meet him. Do you know what he did when I told him at age 10 that I thought another boy was cute? He shoved a broom handle into my mouth until I vomited. He said, "No son of mine is going to be a filthy homo."
Frankie closed her eyes. I'm sorry, V.
Don't be. All I'm saying is some parents aren't worth mourning. There's good ones and there's bad ones. You and me, we had bad ones.
I guess I should be grateful it wasn't worse. He never physically harmed us.
You can get plenty of scars without ever being touched, Virgil said.
You're right. Ever thought of changing careers? You give good shrink.
He winked. You'll get my bill. Virgil pushed back the chair and stood up. He bent down and kissed Frankie on top of the head, and then he disappeared into the Zingari crowd. She felt lonely being alone now. She called Jason, but the call went to voicemail. She called Pam to apologize for their fight, but her sister didn't answer either. And then, ping, another email. It was almost as if her stalker were keeping her company, as if he knew she was alone and he wanted to be there for her. She studied the restaurant again, but if the nightbird was here, he was hiding in a crowd of faces. She opened the email.
You have 10 minutes to save her.
Frankie told herself, do not respond. That was what the security company had said. Never respond. He will try to goad you into replying. That's what he wants, to engage you, to suck you in. Do not respond. She typed out a response on her phone.
Who?
Her finger hovered over the send button. To send or not to send? She knew she was making a mistake by playing his game, and yet the darkness of his messages felt ominous.
She needs you. You have 10 minutes to save her.
No. Frankie deleted the reply without sending it. She deleted the original message. No more games. It was time to go home. With a sigh of relief, she removed her wallet from her purse and peeled off cash to pay for her dinner and wine. She left the money on the table. She looked for Virgil in the crowd to wave goodbye, but she didn't see him.
Outside on Post Street, the night air was cool. Trees shivered in the planter boxes.